This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Dream Town, written by David Baldacci, read by Eduardo Ballerini and Brittany Presley. To Tiffany and Bruno Silva and the Landing Love Project for helping so many in need. Chapter 1. It was New Year's Eve, 1952. Aloysius Archer was 30 years old, once a decorated soldier, and next a humbled inmate. He was currently a private detective, with several years of intense experience trolling the darker side of life. He was riding in a 1939 blood-red Delahaye convertible, with the red top in the down position, because that was how he liked it. He had bought the car a little over 3 years before with lucky gambling winnings in Reno. It had also very nearly cost Archer his life. He still loved the car. Any man with a pulse would. And so would any woman who liked a man with a nice car. He was currently heaving over the roller coaster humps of Los Angeles. The city was decked out in its finest livery for the coming of the new year. That meant the bums of Skid Row had been goose-stepped off the streets by junior coppers who did what they were told. The hookers had been ordered not to solicit on the main thoroughfares, and most everyone had put the lids on their trash cans and brushed their teeth. The town had brought in about 4 million strings of lights, an equal number of balloons, and enough confetti to choke the Pacific. And every actor and actress with a studio contract, and even some without, would be showing their toothy mugs in all the right and wrong places. While the town definitely had its seamy side, the City of Angels had all the tools and incentive to do showy and shallow better than any other place on earth. It could be a wonderful place to live if you had money, were famous, or both, which Archer didn't and wasn't. Over the years he'd worked a slew of tough cases, and had come to know the town and its denizens maybe better than he would have liked. It was a town that took every single dream you had, and then merrily ran it right through the world's biggest meat grinder. And when the famous were famous no more, the meat grinder treatment was even worse, because those people had tasted what life could be like if enough ink was spilled on you and sufficient butts sat in seats to watch you emote. When that ride was over, it was like being dropped from the top of the Empire State Building to land in a squatter's shack in Alabama. Los Angeles had 2 million souls, sprawled over nearly 500 square miles. Some people were crammed into slums, tract housing, and shadily built tenement death traps, like staples in a stapler, while the wealthy and famous had room to both flex and hide. All this in a city founded on the remnants of a village settled by the Tongva, an indigenous Indian tribe who called it Yaanga, which translated to Poison Oak Place. Well, they got that right, thought Archer. But for a private eye, L.A. could be a fascinating study of human beings and all their many foibles. He turned left and then right as he moved from dirty L.A. to rich L.A., and then to dirty and rich L.A. He passed a prowler car and saw two of the LAPD's finest sitting inside and sipping on coffee in vending machine cups. They stared at Archer as he passed, probably wondering whether he'd stolen the car or was delivering it to some Hollywood mogul or a desert sheik who'd bought a piece of the city's myth along with a fancy ride. Archer eyed the prowler in his mirror, hoping it would stay right where it was. To his mind, the LAPD was one of the largest criminal enterprises in the world, and they did it with a smile and a gun where appropriate, or with beatings that didn't show. Archer had had a police baton or two land on his head, and he'd also spent time in the tank on bogus charges merely for asking questions deemed impertinent, meaning ones directed at finding the truth. Because the truth often found LAPD badges mixed in with the other crooks. These coppers were probably taking a coffee break before heading to a string of ghetto street corners, with their dozen-block-deep slums in the rear, to make their quota of busted heads for the week, like the good little foot soldiers they were. They were just one crew in a pitched battle for the soul of the city, and there was no doubt in Archer's mind which faction was winning. If L.A. were a human body, the criminal elements were the capillaries, small, everywhere, not often seen, but absolutely vital to overall life. His destination was Universal Studios. He only knew one person there, but it was an important person, at least to him. Liberty Callahan had left Baytown more than 2 years ago. That was where Archer lived and worked with Willie Dash's very private detective agency. Callahan had gone to Hollywood to make her dream come true in the land of make-believe. As far as he knew, she was still working on making the town believe in her. He'd met Callahan in Reno, where she was a dancer and hoofer at a dinner club. They'd traveled to Baytown together and nearly gotten killed several times along the way. There was nothing like confronting death to cement a friendship. There was a great deal of private detecting to do in L.A. People here seemed to keep killing and robbing and cheating and blackmailing one another to an astounding degree. But when you had a lot of money in one place, some folks were always tempted to take it from both their lawful and unlawful owners. He passed buildings that were intricately cut into the city's steep grade and looked lopsided and unrooted as a result. The roots here were always shallow, never deep. Deep required commitment, and there was none to be had here, at least that Archer could see. Tall, double-stemmed streetlights in the shape of goal posts, which made them look like they were being held up at gunpoint, illuminated the LA night. The NBC sign blinked back at him from Sunset and Vine, while a few blocks south stood the swaggering arch of Paramount Studios. A block over the other way on Hollywood Boulevard, tourists from all over were lined up in front of Grauman's Chinese Theater to stare at handprints set forever in cold, unforgiving concrete. He kept steering his ride east and glanced at the Hollywood sign ablaze in the hills. A disconsolate actress had climbed up on the sign's letter H back in 1932 when it still spelled out Hollywood Land. When she got to the top, she jumped to her death. Archer imagined the meat grinder had gotten to her. She'd probably chosen H because that was the first letter in hell. He pulled up to the main gate at the studio and presented his driver's license to the guard there, a beefy type who looked hot and bothered, although the temps were in the chilly 50s at this time of night. The man's hair was thin and grizzled, his face was fat and wide, and his body matched the face and not the hair. He looked like he'd end up with a coronary if he actually had to hoof it after a gate runner. His holstered .45 slapped against his meaty thigh as he walked around the car, eyeing it like a pretty girl in a swimsuit contest.
"Steering wheel's on the wrong side, bub,"
was his final judgment. Delahaye was a French company, but this particular Delahaye, a Model 165 Cabriolet, had been built for an Englishman, and the wheel had, of necessity, been shifted to the right. "Not from where I'm sitting," Archer replied. Beefy looked at his clipboard.
"Who are you visiting again?"
"Liberty Callahan. She's a friend." The man grinned.
"Lucky man."
"I take it you know her?"
"Gal's got what you call personality."
"Among other things?"
"She's on stage 3. Just follow the signs. You can park right down there,"
he added, pointing the way after handing Archer back his license.
"She's shooting a Roman gladiator picture."
He gave Archer a look that guys give each other when they're thinking about what women could do for them that nothing else can.
"She wears one of them togas."
"I'm sure she wears it better than anyone else." The man gazed at Archer, his brown button eyes greedy and hopeful in their lust.
"When the sun catches it just right, you can see right through the damn thing."
"As I'm sure she can you," Archer said, driving off. Chapter 2. Archer parked the car and followed the signs to Stage 3. Along the way, he passed the casting office, where hopefuls would spend their lives sitting in intentionally uncomfortable chairs, waiting for something that would never happen. The red light was on outside the soundstage, so he leaned against the weathered parchment-colored stucco walls and waited. He spent the time looking down at his brown wingtips and wondering whether he should have chosen the midnight blue serge suit over this brown pinstriped woolen one. He commenced to twirl his fedora between his fingers, an indication of nerves. He hadn't seen Callahan in months. Every time he came to visit the lady, he expected her to have changed somehow. She clearly had the Hollywood bug, which was a virus no medicine could cure. But she'd always been the same woman, at least to him. Even so, there was always tomorrow. Or tonight. A buzzer rang and the light went off, and soon the foot-thick door popped open, and the Roman legionnaires started trooping out. Callahan was among the stragglers, and Archer's face lit up when he saw her. Sometimes it seemed that the only redeeming quality in this whole city came down to this woman, at least for him. She was tall, and her bare feet only 4 inches under Archer's 6'1". Curves in all the right places, naturally blonde hair that danced liberally over her bare shoulders and made his blood race with each bounce. Her face had all the finishing touches that could make men leer for years at a time. Her smile was immediate when she saw Archer, her hug tight and sincere. The kiss she planted on his lips alone made the trip worth it. They were not a couple. They had slept together exactly once. This was back in Baytown, more than 3 years ago. But then, mostly by silent agreement and a few mumbled words over too much alcohol that had, surprisingly, given them sufficient clarity, they decided that their friendship was worth more than occasional sack time, with no clear runway ahead. She was the most beautiful woman of his acquaintance, and she often intimidated the hell out of him, which only heightened the attraction. Shrinking wallflowers had never rocked Archer's boat or heart. He had begun to feel things for her that every man hoped to feel about a woman one day. But maybe those feelings had been there for a long time, only their weight had compressed him into silence. He was thinking of maybe one day soon breaking that silence.
"You made it,"
she said, as though he had braved mighty seas to reach her, instead of driving 80 miles due south on smooth roads. "I can't say no to a pretty girl. It's a weakness." He offered her a lucky strike and lit her and himself up, and they walked down the concrete alley toward the dressing rooms. Cowboys and Indians and 2 Martians reading the next day's call sheets passed by them.
"How's Willie?"
"He's Willie, and Connie is Connie, and Baytown hasn't fallen into the Pacific yet, though it may be only a matter of time." Connie Morrison was Willie Dash's ex-wife and current secretary. They needed each other far more now than when they were married. Willie was a first-rate investigator and had taught Archer more in 3 years than a man had any right to expect. "How's the movie career coming?" he asked, because she would want him to.
"The production I'm on now is strictly B-movie stuff. I mean, the budget is so low, we only have 12 legionnaires. They have to shoot them at really tight angles, and then over and over again to make them look like 1,200. And we don't even have any real lions on set. They just use stock footage of them pawing the air and roaring to edit in, and then shoot the gladiators reacting. The MGM lion is scarier. I mean, it's pathetic."
"Gotten any good parts lately?" he asked, again, because he felt he had to.
"Well, you know that last year I did have a decent role in High Noon with Coop, but you don't know I did a screen test for The Quiet Man last year but didn't make the cut. I would have loved to meet Duke Wayne, but they filmed it in Ireland, and if you're gone from this town too long, they forget about you."
"Anything cooking right now, other than gladiators?"
"Hitchcock is going to be filming Dial M for Murder in the summer. It's based on a play. My agent is arranging an audition. But if that doesn't work out, word is that after Hitchcock finishes Dial M, he might direct another picture called Rear Window. It's supposed to start shooting in November."
She looked at him inquisitively.
"You heard of it?"
Archer puffed on his lucky and shook his head. "I don't read the trades. I have a hard enough time reading my mail in my own mind."
"It's sort of a voyeuristic mystery story. Anyway, there's a nifty female lead character, described as tall, blonde, and assertive. You know, professional with her own career, but still looking for the right man to give her a ring and babies."
"Sounds like the part was written for you, except for the ring and the babies." He gave her a look that perhaps hoped to compel a deeper answer to his statement than was warranted under the circumstances. Only the lady didn't bite. She did a little twirl in her toga and almost collided with a Viking coming the other way. Archer pulled her safely out of the range of both his axe and lecherous glare.
Anyway, when the time is right, my agent will try and get me an audition for that one too. And then maybe a screen test if the role they want me for is big enough. And if I land that part in One in Dial M, it could really be a springboard. I mean, being in not one, but two Hitchcock films in the same year?
The next moment, her hopeful look faded. What's the matter? He asked, noticing this. She glanced at him, and in that look he saw something in the woman Archer had thought he'd never see. Resignation.
Nothing. It's just hard sometimes. You work your guts out and get rejected 100 times to land one lousy part. It gets to you after a while. But I guess there's always tomorrow.
He nipped a piece of tobacco off his tongue as he felt the Hollywood bug inserting itself between them like a border wall. Fingers crossed, he said encouragingly. He didn't think Hollywood was a good place for her, but he also knew how much she wanted to be a star here.
But I've been working steadily. I'm not a star under contract, so I got 3 pictures going at 2 different studios, including this Gladiator pick for Universal. I'm at Warner Brothers next in a spy flick involving atomic secrets. Then I go on location in Arizona in a romantic comedy, again for Warner's. And my name is getting around, and the money is really good. And I'm not even a mid-level actress yet. They can pull in $3,000 a week. I only make half that.
She paused and glanced at him, excitement once more dancing in her eyes.
And, Archer, I just bought a nice 2-bedroom bungalow off Melrose near the country club. And I have my own car.
Archer perked up at this. What kind of car?
A Volkswagen. It's green with a split-screen rear window. You ever seen one?
Not since I was fighting my way through Berlin. Her features turned somber, and he didn't think it was his comment about battling Nazis.
But I turned 30 last month, and the clock is ticking. I'm not Kate Hepburn. My face won't look good playing spinster aunts or being a mom with grown kids. I'll just look old. And I don't want to end up a small lot dust off with a baby spotlight on me for my one line in a lousy picture that'll probably never make it out of the editing room. Or spend my remaining pennies on studio coaches and no-class agents to get me back in the door while people talk crap about me right in front of my face.
She looked at him.
If you see that happening, shoot me, Archer.
He took all this in and said, "Well, if it makes you feel better, I pull in a fraction of what you make when crime is really good, but I do get most Sundays and Christmas off."
I know, I should appreciate what I have, but I worked my rear end off for it. And the story of the casting couch is no myth, let me tell you.
He looked at her sharply. You didn't—
What I did, Archer, is between me, myself, and I.
She looked wistful, which she almost never did.
But I hear TV is really taking off,
she said.
Maybe I should think about trying that.
I saw an episode of Dragnet the other night at Willie's place. It wasn't bad.
I heard they work with the police department to make it authentic.
She glanced sharply at him.
Hey, Archer, you're a real gumshoe. You could be Joe Friday's new sidekick. You'd make a lot more money, and we'd both be actors.
The way she said it was a bit sad, thought Archer. It was as though she just wanted a friend to be out there fighting for a career right alongside her. But I wouldn't have nearly as much fun. So what's the plan for tonight?
Dinner at Chasen's, then drinks at the Coconut Grove. Then we head upstairs to the penthouse suite and ring in 1953 with the bubbly and some VIPs.
How'd you score the penthouse at the Ambassador Hotel?
The director on this garbage movie, Danny Mars, that's how, Archer. It's his wife, Gloria's pad. His third wife's. Gloria has her own money, inherited from back east. And in case you're wondering, no, I am not going to be wife number 4.
Glad to hear it, because 4 is definitely not your lucky number. The thought of her marrying another man had made Archer's heart skip a beat. They walked along arm in arm. They passed what Archer thought looked like Rin Tin Tin, taking a piss on a poor bum trapped in a cheap suit of studio armor. He and Callahan kept right on marching to 1953. Chapter 3. Archer drove them over to West Hollywood and valeted the Delahaye. The slender uniformed man who took the key and gave him a ticket in return scratched his head when he saw the positioning of the steering wheel. "I can park it myself," Archer set off this look. "Only questions are, how much do I charge, and are you a good tipper?"
"Ain't a problem, sir. Mr. Cary Grant's got him a right-hand drive rolls. Jimmy over there knows how to handle the thing."
"Good for over there, Jimmy. Now, except for the bullet hole on the windscreen post, there's not a scratch on her now. And you'll make sure there won't be another scratch when I get her back, right?"
"Bullet hole?"
the man said, his jaw going slack. "Just a misunderstanding. But not another scratch. Capiche?"
"You're the boss."
Archer passed him a buck to seal the deal. They walked in under the long awning to find the place in full swing. A lot of the big stars had their own booths here, and many of them had turned out in the tuxedoed and gowned flesh to welcome in 1953 with steak and asparagus dripping with hollandaise sauce, coconut cream pie, and the best cocktails on Beverly Boulevard. When they got inside, he watched as Callahan looked around at all the legendary stars partying there. Her manner at first became subdued, as though she was as overwhelmed by this as any out-of-towner would have been. But then her expression changed to one of sheer excitement to be in their company.
"Don't look now, but oh my gosh, there's Frank Sinatra and Groucho Marx,"
whispered Callahan. Archer eyed those two gents and their substantial entourages, along with Bob Hope, Milton Berle, and James Cagney, all in various states of sobriety. In a back booth surrounded by male admirers was the woman who was just beginning to take the town by storm. Archer thought if there was a lady to give Callahan a run for her money in the come-hither department, it was Marilyn Monroe. An old-looking Clark Gable, outfitted in a tailored sharkskin suit and loosened burgundy tie, was downing shots at the bar like a man who'd been thirsty his whole life. Word was he'd never recovered from his wife Carol Lombard's going down in that plane a decade before. They were escorted to a table by a guy in a striped linen suit that was far nicer than Archer's, with a fresh gardenia in his buttonhole, expensive shoes on his wide feet, and a quarter-size rock on his finger. Archer had always heard the tips at Chasen's were the best in town. He was very happy that Callahan had insisted on paying. They sat and had their menus delivered by a gal in a tight blue skirt with a yellow rose pinned to her white blouse. They ordered drinks from her, a whiskey highball for Archer and a sidecar for Callahan. While they waited for their cocktails, Callahan looked around.
"I still can't believe I'm part of this world, Archer."
"Don't you come here for dinner all the time?" he said, smiling.
"I'm just a working girl. In fact, I've only been to Chasen's with you, mister."
A few moments after their drinks came and they tapped glasses, a voice called out.
"Elsie, is that you? Is that really you?"
Archer looked up to see a slip of a woman around 40, all sharp angles and energetic intensity, and with straight black hair, approach their table. Through tortoiseshell specks, her green eyes looked like round frog's eggs. Her skin seemed like it had never finished forming, leaving bare the bony emotional edges underneath. Archer figured if she was an actress, that would be one nifty element for the camera to capture.
"Ellie?"
said Callahan, looking as surprised as the other woman.
"Is that you?"
She fingered her dark, slack hair.
"Got tired of being a bottle blonde who slept on curler rolls. Too many blondes in this town. I don't mean you, Elsie." "Sure, I know. It's a swell look on you. Pull up a seat and have a drink. This is my friend Archer. Archer, Ellie. Well, Eleanor Lamb."
They shook hands. As she gave the waitress her drink order, he ran his eye over her again. She was barely 5'2", and the scales would never get to three figures with her. Everything about her, from the cheekbones to the chin to the elbows to the knees, was knife-like. It appeared you could cut yourself in innumerable ways on this lady. Her dress was a fluffy crimson number, with a line of ruffles at odd places. The sleeves ended before the elbows
and the hemline before the bony knees. The stockings were black silk that made her skinny legs look more robust. It somehow all sort of worked. For her part, Callahan was housed in a simple, form-fitting red dress that plugged every curve she had like a 4-inch headline in the LA Times. Around her shoulders was a fringy black wrap, and down below, long, stockinged legs that constantly drew men's attention. "Elsie," Archer said.
"Some people refer to me by my initials,"
explained Callahan.
"Ellie is a screenwriter. The first movie I worked on here was one of her scripts. It was a United Artists film. Where are you now?"
"Same independent production company as before. We were hired to do the UA screenplay."
She took a moment to light up a Chesterfield from a silver cigarette case she slid from her handbag. Archer noticed her hand shook a bit as she took a drag on the Chesterfield, propelling out the smoke from both barrels of her nose. She shot him a glance before looking away.
"I'm working on a script for Columbia as a comeback vehicle for Betty Davis."
She tapped her smoke into the glass ashtray at their table. Archer gave her a puzzled look. "Wait, Betty Davis needs a comeback film?" Callahan said,
"You stay in this town long enough, everybody needs a comeback film."
"And All About Eve was 2 years ago,"
interjected Lamb.
"Which is 20 years in Hollywood time, at least for women."
Archer glanced at Callahan, who appeared to take this comment hard. The rest of her sidecar disappeared down her throat.
"I'm actually working on the project with Danny Mars."
Callahan looked startled.
"The director of the B-movie I'm on is doing Betty Davis's comeback film?"
"Well, he's attached for now. Davis will have final approval on the director, of course."
"Who are you here with, Ellie?"
"Some guy who failed to show up. I don't think you have that problem."
The waitress presented Lamb with her glass of sherry and bitters with a curlicue orange peel, apparently for window dressing. Archer didn't know anyone who really drank sherry unless they had to, but he thought he might just be hanging out with the wrong crowd.
"Archer is an old friend from Baytown, just up the coast. He put his detective work aside for one night to ring in the new year with me."
Lamb swiveled around and laid a look on Archer that he had seen plenty of times before, just not in that particular shade of jarring green wrapped with framed portholes.
"You're a detective? A real one?"
This almost came out as one word. "A private one."
"Private is what I need,"
Callahan said.
"Ellie, why in the world do you need a private eye?"
The frog eyes turned on her with steadfast urgency.
"Because I think someone might be trying to kill me."
Chapter 4. Over the years, Archer had learned that when someone said they thought another human being was trying to off them, they were either hating their life and vying for attention, paranoid and beyond the help of someone like a private detective, or someone indeed was trying to kill them. With Eleanor Lamb, he didn't know yet if it was one of the three or whether he would learn a new reason.
"What makes you say that?"
Archer asked, as he nibbled on a handful of peanuts the Chasins put on every table.
"Have you received any direct threats? And if so, from whom? And why haven't you gone to the cops with them?"
"Geez, Archer, why don't you give the lady the third degree or something?"
exclaimed Callahan.
"It's okay,"
said Lamb.
"Those are all pertinent questions. To answer them, no, I have received no direct threats, so I don't know who might be behind it, and I don't want to go to the cops because it might cost me my job."
"Why would your boss get mad about that?" asked Archer.
"If someone is trying to kill me, it might put the people I work with in danger."
"And who do you work for?"
"Green and Ransom Productions."
"Is there a Green and a Ransom?"
"Bart Green is a prominent producer who's worked with everybody in town. The firm provides an array of services to the studios. Talent, writers, whatever is needed."
"But I thought the studios did all that in-house."
"Mr. Green was a big-time producer with Warners and then at MGM, so he has major connections. He's got film projects going with pretty much every studio in town."
"How did Danny Mars get in the loop to direct Davis?"
interjected Callahan.
He and Mr. Green are longtime friends. The old boys network, you know.
Yeah. Well, I'm waiting for the old girls network to kick in,
quipped Callahan. And Mr. Ransom? Asked Archer.
Miss Cecily Ransom is an up-and-coming writer and director.
A woman director? Said Archer, glancing at Callahan.
Girls do direct films, Archer,
said Callahan in a brusque tone. Archer tacked back to Lamb. Why exactly do you think someone is after you? Lamb took a nervous sip of her sherry, and Archer watched an errant drop of it spoil Chasen's fine table linen.
The first was a weird phone call I got about a week ago at home. It was someone breathing heavy, a man, I think. It said that I was in danger.
Archer hiked his eyebrows and lowered his expectations. He didn't recognize the voice? She shook her head. What else has happened that was weird? He continued.
I've gotten 2 hang-ups in the middle of the night. The phone rings and scares the hell out of me. But when I answer it, all I hear is breathing. And then, click.
Archer sat back, his interest waning. Come on. That just sounds like some drunk or doped-up kids playing around. Next, they'll be teepeeing your house.
Really? Well, I woke up one morning to find my front door wide open.
Any signs that anyone had been in your house? Asked Archer. Was anything taken, or moved around, or was anything left behind? She shuddered.
There was a bloody knife in the kitchen sink.
She paused.
Does that sound like drunk or doped up boys?
Archer leaned forward, engaged once more. Was it one of your knives? She nodded.
A paring knife.
Where did the blood come from?
I have no idea. How could I?
She blinked her green eyes at Archer.
Wait a minute. Are you implying that I put the knife there? Covered in what? My own blood? How dare you?
Her voice had risen as she spoke, and people at several tables looked over. Archer leaned across the table and said in a muted voice, I'm not implying anything, Miss Lamb. I just wanted to know if you had any ideas. And we don't have to share your private business with the rest of the town, do we? She glanced around and lowered her gaze, and when she next spoke, her voice was barely a whisper.
Well, I don't have any ideas. And there was a strange car on my street the past few nights. I think there was a man sitting in it.
You recognize him or the car? She shook her head.
It was a 4-door Ford. Dark blue, I think. It's hard to tell at night.
Okay, look. I think you should go to the cops. It might be nothing. Some stupid guy just messing around with you. But it could also be more than that, especially with the knife and the blood. And the police know how to deal with that sort of thing. They can send a radio patrol car around. But tell me, have you broken up with anyone lately? Got any ex-boyfriends with a beef against you? How about the guy who was supposed to show up tonight? She shook her head dismissively.
We haven't known each other long enough for him to get all creepy.
Callahan added.
Most guys take a little while to work up to pure nasty. It's Mother Nature's built-in escape hatch for women. Darn nice of her.
Archer had to smile at that one. Anyone else with a problem? He asked Lamb. She shook her head but wouldn't meet his gaze. Archer studied her closely and came away certain that she was holding something back. So are you going to go to the cops?
Can't you help me?
She said in a pleading tone. I'm 50 a day plus expenses.
That's not cheap.
Well, I don't get all of it. I work for another guy. And it's not like I work and get paid that much every day. I probably make less in a year than you spend on clothes. And most jobs don't come with the possibility of getting shot or your neck broken.
Okay, I guess I can see that.
And I don't live in L.A. I usually rent a room at the Y to keep costs down. And there'll be a contract for you to sign. I have some in my car.
Heck, Archer, you can stay with me for free,
said Callahan.
I have a spare bedroom now.
She gave him a friendly look that did not raise any possibilities other than sleep. I do like to get a $200 retainer up front. If I don't work through it all, you'll get the balance back.
I don't have my checkbook with me. We'd have to go to my house.
Where do you live?
In a canyon in Malibu, Las Flores?
Archer said. That's where the Sea Lion restaurant is. Used to be the Las Flores Inn. She eyed him with what Archer regarded as unease.
You know Malibu?
Bad things happen in Malibu too, you know. She looked at them nervously.
But Las Flores is a hike from here, and you two are out on the town tonight. How about you come by my office tomorrow?
Where's your office?
Off Wilshire, near San Vicente.
Okay. Just write your home and office address down. I can get the check and have you sign the contract. And then we can head out to your house. Whoever is doing this obviously knows where you live. Lamb took out a piece of paper and pen from her clutch purse and wrote down the address of her office and also that of her house and passed it to Archer. He glanced at it. How do you like living in Malibu?
It was fine until all this started up.
You're near the Malibu movie colony. See a lot of stars out?
None that I can't see in town.
She answered with pursed lips that puzzled Archer. He could understand her being gassed out on the celebrities of the day. But in his limited experience, the movie business was built on relationships. Okay, what about your neighbors?
There's one on either side of me. The Bonhams are currently in France. The other neighbor is Sylvia Danforth. She's 80, widowed, and lives with her cats.
So it's doubtful the threats are coming from them?
Yes, very doubtful.
But what about the Bonhams? Anyone staying at their place while they're away? Lamb glanced guiltily at Callahan.
Look, it's New Year's Eve, and you're here to have a nice dinner. Come to the office around 10.
Not taking the day off, then?
For me, tomorrow is just another day. It'll be quiet. I can get some actual work done.
She gave Callahan a peck on the cheek and disappeared into the crowd. Callahan watched her go and then glanced at Archer.
So?
So what?
What do you think?
He shrugged and lit up a cigarette. I don't think anything. Not yet. What do you know about her?
She's from back east. Went to college there. Boston. She's smart. Well-read.
I thought I caught a bit of Yankee Doodle Dandy underneath the L.A. grease coating.
It does bother me that I didn't know about her working with Mars on the Davis film.
Why would you know? And why would that bother you?
If you don't know what's going on in this town, you can't take advantage of opportunities. I'd love to work with Davis. She'd eat me alive in every scene, but I could still make a splash. And the movie will be big news because she's in it, and I could learn a lot.
How about Lamb personally? She seems a little high-strung to me. Is she prone to hysterics? She's a writer, so her imagination must be good. Could she be making all this up?
No. She does her job and minds her own business.
Well, from what the lady said, she stopped curling and dyeing her hair blonde and went back to her natural brunette with hair straighter than my spine. I wonder why.
She told you why. And she's right. This town has too many damn blondes. The next time you see me, I might have pulled a Maureen O'Hara, and all you see is red.
Do you know Green or Ransom?
I've certainly heard of Bart Green. He's done a lot. Knows everybody, like Ellie said. I don't know Cecily Ransom, though I'd like to.
Why?
She's the change this town needs, Archer. Ransom is making pictures that are gritty, honest, and bone deep. Oh, I'd love to work with her.
If I meet her, I'll put in a good word. You ever been to Lamb's house?
She had a one-bedroom in West Hollywood when I first met her.
So the move to Malibu was fairly recent then?
I guess within the last 2 years or so. Is that important?
Malibu isn't cheap, and most working writers like to be nearer the action. She's not an heiress or anything, is she?
Not that she mentioned, and she never acted like she was in the money.
Archer finished his smoke and killed it off in the ashtray. Let's eat. But his mind was now clearly elsewhere. Chapter 5 Archer next drove them to Wilshire Boulevard and through the gates of the Ambassador Hotel, a 1,200-room extravaganza set on over 20 acres, with pools, tennis courts, columns of private bungalows, and enough pretentiousness to satisfy the most inflated of egos. A spiffy valet in a mauve-colored uniform took the car key with a grin.
That's a Delahaye 165 Cabriolet, he said.
As it is, said a surprised Archer. How do you know that?
My granddad's French, he said. He worked at the company before World War I.
Great, but this has the steering wheel on the other side of the English Channel. They entered the main dining room. It had once been the grand ballroom for the hotel. 1,000 diners were eating and drinking, all while sitting next to fake, full-sized palm trees with mechanical monkeys swinging overhead. Archer knew the Academy Awards had been held here numerous times, and he had a feeling that Callahan would love nothing more than to walk down the red carpet with that little statuette. Now he looked at Callahan, and she eyed him back.
I won't be long,
she said in an apologetic tone. Sure you won't, he said dully. They had talked about this on the way over. Callahan was not really here for a drink. She was here to work. While Callahan went to mingle and see who she needed to see, Archer reversed course and went directly to the hotel bar, which looked like the world's biggest palm tree had sprouted right behind the smiling counterman. Archer didn't want a frond in his face, just a drink in his hand. And a minute later, in return for $2, he was saddled with a whiskey and water, where the whiskey appeared as a nominal oil slick on the water's surface. One fresh-faced girl, presumably from out of state and there with her equally goggle-eyed parents, came up to him and, giggling excitedly, asked if he was famous and could she have her picture taken with him. I'm famous, but only in my own mind, he had dutifully replied. And she still had her picture taken with him and would go back to wherever to tell everyone about her once-in-a-lifetime encounter with someone who was so famous he denied being so. He downed his weakened whiskey and thought, only in this town. He got up once and peered into the grove and watched as self-important tuxedoed men sat around in their wicker chairs ignoring their meals and their powdered and primped wives and girlfriends while looking for fresh, if wildly impossible, female prospects. For their part, the wives and girlfriends smiled regally and tried to rise above it all, while really wanting to strangle their gents. Despite the flow from an air-conditioning system, sweaty waiters carried trays piled with steaks rare, oceans of mushrooms, and mountains of fried onion rings. A live orchestra played away, while lithe and limber dancing girls helped to boogie-woogie and tango in the new year. Ingots of golden light illuminated the show to such a bright degree that Archer eyed several patrons who had donned sunglasses. When Callahan circled back to him later, he said, none too happily, see who you needed to see? Or do I have to sit here hydrating with more water than whiskey while you make another pass through the chow line? She stroked his cheek in apology.
I know, Archer. It gets me down too.
He got her a drink because she looked like she needed it. Is it really worth it?
I don't know. Yet. And look at you.
Look at me what?
You're right here in the thick of it in wild and woolly L.A. Must be a reason.
Maybe I just like to be close to you, he said, eyeing her over his tumbler whiskey.
Right. When you work down here, the only ones you're close to are your clients and whoever ends up dead. And you're thinking about Ellie Lamb. I know that look.
I admit she interests me.
Why?
She's holding back. Clients who lie to you are always interesting.
What makes you think she's lying?
Just call it a professional hunch. She may not know who's doing these things to her, but I think she has an idea why they are.
If she does, why won't she tell you?
And therein lies the interesting part. Chapter 6. They entered the hotel's lobby and took the automatic elevator up to the top floor. Callahan presented her engraved invitation to the petite young woman with a Dutch boy haircut who was checking the guests in. She obviously knew Callahan and was a little starstruck.
Oh, Miss Callahan,
she squeaked.
Everyone here wants to meet you.
Callahan said,
Donna, you're cute. Go get a drink and enjoy yourself.
But I have to make sure nobody crashes the party.
She squeaked again.
Trust me, honey. They want people to crash it. That's how you know you're really having a party worth going to in this town.
While Callahan went to powder her nose, Archer walked around. There was an odd mixture of black oak paneling in one room, cloister-vaulted ceilings in another space,
and bleached wood floors in the library. And then there was a waxed ceramic tile floor, arrayed in a complex geometric pattern in the living room. Anyone drunk looking down at that was going to toss their cookies and leave their own pattern, Archer concluded. Positioned everywhere were mammoth bright blue Chesterfields paired with painfully straight-back Spanish-style wooden chairs. Bowls of cigarettes and mints and nuts were on every low table. On every high table was booze. Archer spotted what he thought was an original Rembrandt on the wall. That it was something to consider that the painting was worth far more than he would make in his entire life. There was a circular mirror on the ceiling in the large dining room, which was filled with massive Baroque pieces that would have looked dated in the '20s. He did wonder if the ceiling mirror theme was repeated in the master bedroom. A platoon of waiters with slicked back hair and white dinner jackets was handing out trays of champagne and canapés. The more serious male drinkers were lined up at the portable bars, looking like a stiff one, or four, was exactly what was needed to propel them to 1953. A lavish blonde wood radio, phonograph, and television console with curved lines was set against one wall, partnered with a tall glass-doored record cabinet. When Archer took a look at the record collection, he found far more jazz and R&B than crooners and classical music. He picked out one record and looked at the label.
"That's Ray Charles. He's blind,"
said a voice behind him. He turned to see an auburn-haired woman with a Veronica Lake peekaboo standing there with a drink in one hand and a long-barreled cigarette in the other. She was around 40 and flavored with an exotic perfume. The woman's high-slitted Saks dress fit her figure like a hot wax mold. High-heeled gilt slippers graced her small feet. The pale, freckled skin of her upper thigh arrayed against the emerald green dress looked marvelous to Archer. Her small, red lipsticked mouth looked like trouble, though, and her amber eyes matched the mouth. She looked expensive, and no doubt was. These were the times when Archer was thrilled he was poor. "Is that right?" She bit down on her porcelain cigarette holder.
"I think he's going to be really big."
"Good for him. I can't carry a tune with a shovel." She put out a hand.
"I'm Gloria Mars."
He shook it. "Archer." Mars was the Roman god of war, and she struck him as gladiator-like. Her features were hard-edged, her manner was swaggering and confident, and her lean frame portended strength. In his mind, he dubbed her Warrior.
"I saw you come in with Liberty Callahan. She's in my husband's next picture. It's a piece of crap, but I'm sure Liberty's already told you that. Danny just likes swords and shields, fight scenes and busty women in see-through garments. She's wasting her talents with this one."
"She'd be glad to hear that."
"Oh, I already told her. You look like you need a drink. What's your poison?"
"Can you do a White Russian? Or will that get me up before Joe McCarthy's committee?"
"You hang around long enough, Archer, you'll find I can do anything. And screw McCarthy. You mark my words on him, too. That son of a bitch is on the way out."
She left him and went in search of a mixer man to orchestrate his drink. When she came back with it in an old-fashioned tumbler, they clinked glasses, and he took a sip.
"You like?"
she asked, her eyes glistening like they'd been splashed with tonic. "Yes, I do. I hear you come from back east. You like L.A.?"
"Some days. Most days I want to shoot everyone in it, and I don't mean with a camera."
"I get that, Warrior," thought Archer. "Nice place you have here."
"Danny tells everybody that it's his. It's not. We have a prenuptial agreement. This isn't my first rodeo. When we go our separate ways, he can find someplace else to live."
"Not betting on going the distance with him?"
"I play the odds, just like I do with the ponies."
"So why'd you marry him, if you don't mind my asking?"
"I do mind, but I'll tell you anyway. He used to be really great in bed."
The eyes ran down him like an X-ray machine.
"It's not like Danny is going to thrill me with his culture. He grew up on a farm in Oregon. Came here in the '20s to get away from cow shit."
He sipped his drink and said, "Ran into Eleanor Lamb earlier tonight. Understand she's working on a script for your husband to direct Betty Davis." She eyed him coolly.
Bart Green is just throwing him a bone. Only Danny doesn't know it, or doesn't want to admit to knowing it. No way in hell Betty Davis is letting Danny direct her. It would be like Lassie directing Brando, and that's an insult, actually, to the dog.
So Green and your husband go way back, I understand?
Farther back than me and Danny, but we've only been married 3 years. That's the number of wife I am, by the way. 3.
You know Lam well? She looked over Archer's shoulder and didn't answer right away.
We've spent some time together. We're certainly not best friends or anything. Why?
She might be in need of my services. The X-ray look came out again. She moved closer, and the bare skin of her thigh smacked the flesh of Archer's free hand. He didn't move it, because he wanted information. Besides, her smooth skin felt nice.
And what services do you perform for women, Archer?
I'm a private investigator. Oh, and I take on male clients, too. She moved away from him. He saw a tiny red patch on her leg, where his hand had maybe stroked it. She took a drag on her smoke.
Why does she need a PI?
Why does anyone need a PI? They have a problem they want solved.
And what is her problem?
Mars asked, a line of worry suddenly creasing her brow, which intrigued Archer. Can't get into it. Professional ethics. But what can you tell me about her?
You sound like you're investigating your own client.
Archer just likes to be thorough, don't you, Archer?
Callahan had a glass of champagne in one hand and her clutch purse in the other. Her nose and the rest of her face looked superbly powdered. That's right, and getting to know the client often helps solve the problem.
Liberty! You never told me you had such a tall, dark, handsome, and curious friend.
I like to keep him under wraps. The competition here is murder.
Mars plucked out her smoke from the holder, dumped it on a passing tray, and loaded in a fresh cigarette she took from a crystal glass stuffed with them on a highly polished refectory table. Archer lit her up, and she blew smoke out of her nostrils.
To answer your question, Ellie always struck me as a straight-laced, nose-to-the-typewriter type. Very focused. Once she knows what she wants, she goes out and gets it. She's not a party girl. She was invited to this party, but I don't think she's going to show.
You know anything of her personal life?
I've been out to her place in Malibu.
Why was that?
A few times Danny needed some script notes delivered to her, and I was going that way. Another time she had us over for dinner with Bart and his wife.
Why does she live in Malibu?
Why does anyone live in Malibu? For the sand? For the privacy?
A little pricey for a typewriter type. Mars gave him an unreadable look.
Maybe Lam has another source of funds. People do, you know. My grandfather worked with J.P. Morgan, and my mother's side comes from U.S. trust money. I freely admit I did nothing to earn it. But I haven't squandered it either. I'm a girl who lives on the interest and doesn't touch the principal. And I don't let Danny touch it either.
Any other thoughts? Asked Archer.
Danny spends more time with her. You might want to talk to him.
Thanks. Can you point me in the right direction?
It's easy. Find the cheapest-looking dame here with the biggest boobs, and he'll be the really tall, bald guy right beside her, looking down her dress for the sheer thrill of it.
Callahan hooked him by the arm.
Come on. I'll introduce you.
Chapter 7.
What the hell are you doing, Archer?
Scolded Callahan after they walked away from Gloria Mars.
Ellie didn't want anyone she works with to know she hired a PI. I bet Gloria is going to phone Bart Green right now and tell him.
Why isn't Bart Green here for the party, if he and Mars are best buddies?
He likes Danny, sure, but he's going to be boozing and celebrating with folks a few steps above this crowd. The only reason Danny got this kind of turnout is because it's in the penthouse at the Ambassador. But my point is, now Green is sure to find out.
It's a calculated risk, Liberty. And if someone is trying to kill Lam and succeeds, everyone's going to know about it anyway. But if the threat is coming from close by, having them unnotice that a PI is digging around might give them pause.
I hope you're right.
Gloria Mars doesn't like her husband very much.
And that surprised you. I thought you handled divorce cases.
Maybe I was just hoping there was one happily married couple in this damn town.
Not in this price range, but you keep right on hoping.
Do you see Danny Mars? Asked Archer.
I do. He's about 6'6" and bald as a cue ball, so he's hard to miss. And Gloria was spot on. There he is, next to Miss D Cup of 1952.
Is that her official name, or did her mother give her another?
I just call him like I see him, and I see two really big ones right now.
You want to see if you can pry him away from her? She bumped him with her hip.
You think there's any doubt I can?
Archer held up both hands in surrender. You could seduce the collar off a bishop.
You should have heard me in confession. The priests enjoyed it way more than I did.
She sauntered away, and in about 30 seconds, Danny Mars was shaking Archer's hand while leering at Callahan. Mars was at least 15 years older than his wife, had the neck of a water buffalo and the face to match. His brow furrows were so deep Archer could have hidden paper clips in between them. He had on a suit of creamy white gabardine with a yellow and blue checked ascot at his throat, and his shirt was a bright orange silk. His pocket square matched the ascot. His white shirt cuffs had gold-plated links. His shoes were brown calfskin. A man who took care with his appearance, Archer concluded. He ordinarily didn't trust such men. They were too calculating, and usually had a lot to hide. She explained Archer's interest in Ellie Lamb.
You know, she has been acting a little strange lately, said Mars.
How so?
She's been writing from her house, not the office.
Why'd she move to Malibu?
Maybe it's for the sea air and lying on the beach.
She's in one of the canyons, said Archer.
Well, you'd have to ask her,
said Mars, as his gaze worked the room. When did she move out there? Asked Archer.
Couple years ago or so, something like that. Hold on there, boy.
Mars stopped one of the waiters and nabbed a glass of champagne off his tray, and at the same time neatly slipped an arm around Callahan's waist.
Now this gal is going places. After my new film comes out, everybody's going to be talking about her.
When his hand dipped to her buttocks and stayed there, Callahan said,
Time to powder my nose again, Archer. I'll leave you boys to it.
Archer knew young actresses had to powder their noses all the time. Mars quickly turned to Archer.
How is she in the sack? Amazing, right?
I wouldn't know, lied Archer. We're just friends. Mars eyed him closely.
You're not one of them pansy boys, are you?
Not that I know of. Lamb ever mention any problems? You ever meet any guy she was dating?
I wasn't aware she was dating anyone. For all I know, she likes women.
He finished his champagne and grabbed another one off a passing tray. He eyed the waiter carrying it as he walked off.
I don't know why they don't just stick with the colored waiters. They're reliable, and they don't look at you all funny like the Japs do. These Mexies I just don't trust. They put too much grease in their hair, sticky fingers. I'll have to get Gloria to count the silverware.
I really don't trust anybody, regardless of skin color. Mars gave him a puzzled look.
Whose side are you on, anyway?
Tell me why we're fighting and I'll pick a side. Mars seemed to think he was joking.
You always this funny?
It's the booze. So no idea on anybody Lamb might be seeing?
No. And why does she need a PI?
He added with a growl. She never talked to you about it?
I'm the director. A king doesn't get personal with the chambermaid.
You really need to read more history. I understand you and Bart Green are good friends, Archer said, deftly moving the conversation where he wanted it to go next. Mars set his champagne flute down and lit up a Pall Mall.
I've been in Hollywood for 30 years, and I've known Bart for 29 of them. He's not all that much older than me, but he was well up the food chain by the time I hit town. But he's been great to me, always throwing stuff my way. It's why I'm working with Ellie Lamb.
He paused and looked at his cigarette.
We're kind of like brothers, although he rose a lot higher than I have. C'est la vie?
But it beats Oregon and cow shit. Mars grinned at him, but the motion didn't light up his features, because there was nothing genuine behind it.
Gloria likes to throw that in my face. Yeah, I grew up in the middle of nowhere, and worked my ass off to get out. She grew up on Fifth Avenue with truckloads of money, none of which she earned, went to an elite women's college, and has never had to work a day in her life. So who has the right to talk cow shit?
I'm a working man just like you. Mars genuinely smiled this time and raised his glass.
To working men everywhere.
I understand you're in line to direct the Betty Davis picture that Lam is scripting. Mars's genial look faded a few waltz.
Well, Miss Davis has the final say on that, but we had a good first meeting, and Ellie's script is coming along.
What's the storyline?
Officially under wraps.
When is Lam supposed to have it finished?
Soon. I hope whatever she has going on won't mess that up,
he added with a glare aimed at Archer.
I got a lot riding on this. It could lead to bigger and better things.
I understand you've been to her place in Malibu.
Nice house, high up in the canyon, like you said.
He tapped his chest.
Almost had trouble breathing at that altitude. I'm more of a sea-level guy.
So she never told you why she chose Malibu to dig in? Mars started to shake his head, but then said,
Wait a minute. Oh, yeah, I recall it was because of a friend who lived there. Ellie wanted to be closer to that person.
That person have a name? Mars shook his head.
I meet so many people, and I'm lousy with names.
He glanced at Miss Decup, who had a line of men just waiting to tell the lady how they could make her a star.
Now I do remember faces really well.
Just faces? Said Archer, who had followed his gaze to the woman. The man barely tried, and thus failed, to look shocked.
I'm a married man, Archer.
Archer drained his white Russian dry. To married men everywhere. Chapter 8 Archer sat on the bed in Callahan's spare room, staring at his shoes. The house was decorated with a bohemian flair that he knew was all Callahan. This was not the land of tea cozies, patchwork quilts, and dusty knickknacks. The woman had hit the 1950s in full stride, with colorful walls, minimalist chrome and wood furnishings, and large ceramic dishes like the kind they made in Laguna Beach hanging on the walls. The kitchen had every convenience GE and others could offer, like a dishwasher, a garbage disposal in the sink, an electric range, and even a deep freezer that was large enough to hold an elk. The coffee table was topped by recent copies of Daily Variety and The Hollywood Reporter. He had brought along a map of the stars and pretended to have found her new house on it. Her laugh had been worth the 50 cents. There were also paintings that would never have seen the light of day in any grandma's house. On the wall of his room was a painting of a naked woman. She was grotesquely large, with bloated breasts and swollen thighs and belly, and was holding what Archer would delicately describe as a cucumber, broken in half. Callahan said it was done in the avant-garde style. He'd asked her what she saw in it, and got at first a coy look in return.
Life, Archer, only from a woman's perspective.
He and Callahan had kissed on the stroke of midnight in the ambassador's penthouse. Then they, and apparently everyone else, had gotten the hell out of Dodge, including at least one of the hosts. As Archer was waiting in the valet line, he had seen Danny Mars driving off with Miss Decup in his silver Rolls. He didn't know where Gloria had gotten to. Maybe she was still in the penthouse with one of the Mexican waiters, shorn of slitted gown and gilt slippers and white jacket and pants, respectively. They could be lying on their backs on the dining room table looking up at the ceiling mirror and contemplating the prospects of a heady 1953. He continued to sit there until he saw Callahan's light go out in her bedroom. He waited 10 minutes more, and then went into the next room, found the phone book, and looked at his watch. It was 2:05. He looked up Eleanor Lamb's number in Malibu and made the call. If she was there, he'd hang up. She might be more than just the worker bee writer with nothing more complicated in her life than reams of heavy bond paper and a mountain of Corona ribbon and dreams of crafting comeback stories for aging stars. If so, he wanted to understand her, and maybe help the woman. The phone rang 3 times, and then a voice said, Hello? It was a man. Okay, this was not starting off like he wanted it to. Archer made his voice high-pitched and echoey.
Can I speak to Eleanor Lamb? Do you have any idea what time it is?
Yeah, I do. What are you doing up?
The man didn't answer.
Can I speak to her?
Who the hell are you?
Her brother. I wanted to wish her Happy New Year.
She doesn't have a brother.
The line went dead. Archer slowly put down the phone.
He could call in the L.A. County cops. But when the dispatcher asked him what was wrong, what was he supposed to say? That a guy had answered an unmarried woman's phone at 2 a.m. and hung up on him? They would just tell him that Eleanor Lamb had gotten lucky on New Year's Eve. If Archer pushed it, that would get him a quick trip to the can for wasting police time. He left a note for Callahan just in case he didn't get back before she woke up. She had told him she wasn't due on set today. That meant the lady would be sleeping until well past noon. He pulled his street map from the Delahaye's glove box, found Las Flores Canyon Road on it, and set off. Chapter 9. The weather was chilly, and it looked like it was going to rain again, so he'd put up the top. He'd also pulled his Smith & Wesson 38 from the glove box and inserted it in his shoulder holster. He didn't like carrying a gun after World War II, but he liked dying even less. He passed through neighborhoods where the old palm trees were losing their luster and the older homes their integrity. Many of these places were now renting out as tourist traps. If the water wouldn't turn on or the heat didn't work, he'd get a sob story about stolen pensions and unpaid hospital bills from the owners who lived in the basement or over the garage. He next passed various renditions of Skid Row, which backstopped the industrial hide of L.A., like a long-ignored malady now out of control. As he left L.A. proper and headed west, the Pacific was etched in the darkness as a long black stripe until the breakers ruptured white and sharp onto the golden sand. He drove through moneyed Santa Monica and then past Pacific Palisades, where folks who didn't have the bank account to get into Malibu would put down semi-gilded roots. Far out in the water, he saw a single light, probably a cargo ship heading in or out. He watched the light until it vanished in a marine fog that sprouted up around here like mushrooms after rain. Soon Archer got within a pistol shot of the ocean, and the drum of the waves seemed to unspool like a movie in his head. The breakers were moodily fascinating to watch, though the ending was always the same. He turned off the road near the Sea Lion restaurant. Back in the day, the place had been built as a destination for travelers because it was at the end of the public road in Malibu. It was only fairly recently that the beaches of Malibu had been opened for public consumption. Across from there, the single bright light of the Albatross Hotel blazed away. Archer thought he could hear some late-night New Year's Eve partygoers splashing around in the pool. That place was a cash cow for any PI with even a modicum of talent. He had personally handled a half-dozen divorce cases where the photos and recordings and other details he'd amassed at the Albatross had given his female clients the wherewithal to take their adulterous husbands to the proverbial cleaners. He'd always been amazed by the fact that many of these men hadn't realized that the distance between L.A. and Malibu wasn't enough to overcome their wives' ingenuity and anger.
"It's 30 miles, pal,"
one dazed husband had told Archer as they sat out in the hall of the L.A. County Superior Court. His Albatross honey was sitting outside in his Bentley, waiting for her newly freed man. But maybe not as eager as before, since the little wife had taken him for half.
30 damn miles!
Ever heard the phrase, a woman scorned? Archer had told him. The man wiped the sweat off his brow.
I don't have to hear it, buddy. I lived it.
If you're going to walk the aisle with the pretty gal out in your car, then pull the same on her. Do it in another country. Tijuana's not that far, but it's more than 30 miles.
Don't worry, there won't be a next time.
They near finally growing up, pal, Archer had replied, before walking off. He turned right and made his way up Las Flores Canyon Road. A house light in the canyon above the fog line winked down on him. One of 17 canyons in Malibu, Las Flores grew very steep very fast. The darkness, which was pretty complete already, was thrown into pitch blackness by the canyon walls. He drove slowly, both so he wouldn't hit anything, but also because he was afraid of missing Lamb's house. He actually did miss it, and had to backtrack, finally pointing his headlight at a drab brown mailbox with the right numbers on it. There was also a four-door dark blue Ford parked across the street from her house, so she'd been telling the truth about that. Archer drove around a bend in the road, killed his lights, and then his engine. He got out and made his way back up the canyon road with a turned-off flashlight in hand. He squatted on his haunches and eyed the Ford. He saw no movement inside, not even a shadow trying not to move and pretend it wasn't there.
He pulled his gun and crept up to the back of the vehicle, doing his best to keep out of the sight lines of the car's mirrors. He reached the car and edged over to the rear window. The back seat was empty. So was the front. He tried the trunk hatch and found it unlocked. Nothing. He checked the car's registration. In the beam of his light, he saw it was owned by one Cedric Bender, with an address in Anaheim. He pulled out a pencil and his notebook and wrote this down along with the license plate number. He closed the car door and headed up the path to Lamb's house. He shone his light down to see the flagstones with grass growing between as they zigzagged up to a large Spanish-style home. The place had white stucco walls, a red tile roof, and small Moorish-style windows with honeycombed window panes set in silver trim, and windows surrounds painted green. He could smell wood smoke coming from somewhere, even as the breakers down below hurled their sound tentacles up here. Fire and water, all tied up in a neat sensory bow. He saw the sleek two-door silver coupe in a carport next to the house. He touched the engine. It was cold. He tried the doors, but they were locked. He took a moment to write down the coupe's plate number. If this was Lamb's ride, he could confirm that later. He'd rather the lady confirmed it right now, even if she got mad at him for waking up her and her sleepmate. He decided to bypass the front door and headed to the rear. A set of colorful Mexican tile steps led him up to the rear yard. The smell of eucalyptus was so prominent, it was like someone had interjected a liter of it directly into his nostrils. The sharp, dry chaparral grabbed at his trousers. The clay that made up the canyons was geologically unstable, resulting in the areas being acutely susceptible to mudslides when the hard rains came, which they always did. On top of that, the thick brush and Santa Ana dry winds made for frequent wildfires, with the chaparral being one of the prime igniters. In spite of all the flooding and burning, the folks just kept coming. Maybe a swarm of locusts might do the trick and get the builders and home buyers to knock it off. But he doubted it. In the distance, Archer heard a fox scream, and then another one answered right back. Maybe they were celebrating the new year, too. Then a coyote chimed in. Now they just needed a bear and they'd have a quartet. He came around to a concrete patio, on which sat a couple of thick-boned teak chairs around a table with a decorative tile top in blues and gold and a beige umbrella with a frilly edge set in the down position. A small corner fountain in the shape of an urn and raised up on some rough stone slabs gurgled away like a dying man with a slit throat. A hedge of cypress shielded the rear yard from the scrub oaks clinging precariously to the canyon's edifice. Trailing lobelia rising out of the dirt had tacked itself to the home stucco, adding a dash of color. And there was a pool, oval in shape. He could smell the chlorine as it rose off the surface. He put his hand in the water and was surprised. It was heated. That wasn't cheap. The back door was locked. There was an enclosed deck on the upper level that one reached by a set of metal circular stairs. So Archer reached them and went up. The beige French door leading into the house was not locked. He opened it and went inside. His light showed him this was a bedroom. The bed was made, and there were no discarded clothes anywhere that he could see. He stood in the middle of the room listening. The house was as still as any morgue he'd ever been in. Yet there was nothing scary about a morgue. Other than the coroner, everyone else was dead.